I think what I'm going to talk about today goes really very well with the papers that we've heard so far. I hope you will agree. As you heard, I have a new book coming out on Chanel, and this is not taken directly from it, but it is the sort of more conceptual part that they preferred I not focus on so much in the book, but it's important to me. It's about Chanel's extraordinary influence, what made it possible, and how that, whatever it is that made it possible, relates to the rise of fascism and the later implications of that. There are three parts to my talk. I will do some very brief background on Chanel with this crowd. I don't think I need to do very much of that. I will be focusing on the interwar period and the way her business developed into a kind of mass mythic movement with strong nationalist undertones. I have images of her work also, in addition to her fashion images, her work in theater costuming, which is very important to me. I'll go over some aspects of fascism in a very general way, particularly some of the mechanisms of pageantry on which it relies, its visual aesthetic, its specific and very vexed relationship to fashion. And finally, in the last section, I will draw these parts together to try to tease out what I see as the curious and powerful relationship that has actually been ignored between Chanel's movement, which I now call Chanelism, and European fascism. In an interview with the New York Times, André Malraux declared that only three French names would ever remain from the 20th century, and they were de Gaulle, Picasso, and Chanel. And I think that's a fair assessment. I think that for a century now and more, it's safe to say that millions of women wake up every day, and whether they realize it or not, are actually costuming themselves as some version of Coco Chanel. I don't need to go over all of the specifics that she did. You're more familiar probably than I with her history. But just as a quick run through, oh, I should explain. This is the work of a French graffiti artist who calls himself Zeus. And he does installations, graffiti, and sort of stealth art using mostly the Chanel logo. Here he's painted it on a woman's back, but you can find them on walls and in subway stations, art galleries, and he has a manifesto that goes with it, which I won't go into now, but it's kind of wonderful. Okay, what do I do? I wanted to just read these three quotations quickly to you. Paul Morand was a biographer of Chanel's and her close friend, and some of you may know him as a great fascist sympathizer who was thrown out several times from the Académie Française and then reinstated. Speaking to Morand, Chanel said, "I was destiny's tool for a necessary cleansing operation." Paul Morand said of her that she was the exterminating angel of 19th century style, by which he was referring to her elimination of elaborate frippery, but I think it echoes with other things Paul Morand has said, to wit, in an essay on racial cleansing in 1933, he famously said, "Every country except ours is killing its vermin," by which he meant the Jews. Jersey's separate. Those are familiar to all of you. This is 1917. It's very much a legacy of World War I, lightweight, uncorseted. The Chanel body was a breathing, sexually alive entity, very physically mobile, and had a kind of visual speed, not unlike that of men's suits. And of course, there was an undertone of androgyny. Here's a 1930s jersey ensemble. She didn't only change the outline of women's figures, she changed the materials they wore, introducing most especially the famously ignominious knit jersey, priorly only used for men's underwear, or mostly. That's a later suit. This led to her style being called luxurious poverty. That's Paul Poiret, you know. We have her to thank largely for the popularity still of the tan, extreme thinness. Her physical fitness mania is also well known. And her look was based largely on herself, and this is going to be an important point for me. She patterned her look almost entirely on her own slim, straight, boyish figure, creating what Peter Wallin called the internalized corset, meaning, of course, that the corset structure was recreated by the personal discipline of diet and exercise. I do think that no other individual before or since has ever stamped a personal vision so strongly on so many. In 1961, the New York Times said, "This is the greatest transformer of women in our time." She was also the first designer ever to grant official permission for copies to be made of her work. And so by the mid-50s, versions of her look were everywhere in Europe and America. "What is Chanel?" asked a magazine in 1956. The answer, "What every woman is wearing without knowing it." So how do you explain such power for one person and such longevity of influence? And I think the answer lies in the particular confluence of two things: Chanel's self-created myth and the historical moment in which she reached the peak of her fame, the years between 21 and 38, the interwar period. So myth, a myth is an origin story, right? Oedipus is a myth, Genesis is a myth. Myth, writes Philippe Lacoulabat in his wonderful small book, The Nazi Myth, is fiction in its strongest sense, a fiction whose role is to propose, if not impose, models or types with which the individual, a city, or even an entire people can conceive of itself or identity itself. Myth is an instrument of identification, and this is something Chanel understood intuitively. Most powerful was her creation of her own mythic character, Coco, Gabrielle Chanel's alter ego, which had its own origin story, which was infused with the entire design universe she created, and tapped, I think, into very deep desires whose scope always exceeds the sartorial. Just to go over very briefly her famous biographical story, probably you're all very familiar. There have been a lot of movies too, although some of them get it wrong. She was born in 1883, extremely poor, poor as you can be, orphaned young and raised with almost no education in a convent orphanage. When she moved from that into a kind of school for older girls, there were two types of students: those who were utterly destitute and had no family, not a cent, and those who had a little bit of help from family who contributed or visited them occasionally. Chanel was in the first group. The groups wore different clothes. The utterly destitute, total wards of the state who had nothing wore a special black uniform and had to serve the other girls and eat at a separate table. In other words, Chanel learned a lesson that she would hold on to very profoundly for the rest of her life, which is, what you wear is who you are. Yet over time, she propelled herself into the very highest reaches of European society, and by the time she passed away, which was in 1971, she was one of the most famous women in the world, and I believe the wealthiest woman in Europe who was not of royal extraction. In part, she did this via well-chosen lovers who bankrolled her for a while, but it was also her innate talent for cultural translation, but also emulation. And what she did with those talents was create her character, Coco. What is Coco? Coco was an athletic, tennis-playing, horseback-riding, sexually independent, glamorous, unmarried, founder of an empire, a modern woman. A feminine personage, wrote Maurice Sachs, never before seen, a new being. And to perpetuate this new being required techniques, publicity techniques, which she turned out to be very good at. She was her own best advertisement, and she lived very highly public adventures, dressed always in her own, essentially costumes, her own designs. There were a stream of newspaper and magazine articles and the gossip columns, society pages devoted to her always, and she made sure that when she was doing something, it would be chronicled, whether she was, you know, horseback riding, lounging on the Lido, or at home in her lavishly decorated apartment. This is from a 1937 perfume ad, but it was photographed in her own home with text copy that said, "Chanel is an artist in living." And the idea was, buy the perfume, step into this world, step into the costume, and you too would live amid art. There was an era Chanel wrote this. There was an era when one had to be Chanel. A Chanel dress, or more precisely, the Chanel dress, had talismanic power, which could absolutely control one's destiny. That's her writing about herself. Okay. So the self-consciousness is evident. In this way, Chanel did not merely star in her own myth, she conferred it to other people. When people bought her clothes or the millions of copies, they bought the concomitant story to put on with those garments, a fantasy of a woman's life that elicited a profound desire for emulation. And that was her real revolution, because as you know, other people were making clothes that looked a lot like her clothes. Even Karl Lagerfeld said you can't tell the difference sometimes between a Patou drawing and a Chanel drawing, or a V&A drawing and a Chanel drawing. What she did was she created this desire to emulate her life and a character that was portable and desirable. I call it wearable personality, and we're all still wearing it to some degree or another. I can look around and tell you, her striped shirt, flat shoes, several little black dresses. Yes, other people had those things, but it's Chanel that we're sort of channeling. This Coco character coalesced into something instantly recognizable, and it was worn equally by aristocrats and royalty and shop girls on city buses, and she loved that. She even turned her physical body underneath into part of this infinitely reproducible fashion system, making the acquisition of the slim, perennially youthful body a requirement for wearing her clothes. And she was a great public advocate for exercise and diet. I created a new silhouette, she wrote. All my customers became slim, slim like Coco. Women came to me to purchase thinness. Thanks, Coco. Over time, this character, Coco, acquired greater gravitas. From her free-spirited playgirl, Coco Chanel then came to be associated with the trappings of a kind of parallel aristocracy, a parallel military, via a visual lexicon of status, which was often borrowed from the people who were close to her in her life. So, for example, during the early 1920s, she was involved famously with the Grand Duke Dmitry Romanov, who was one of the murderers of Rasputin. He was the nephew of the last Tsar, and he was in exile. He was also an early fascist sympathizer, and he knew Hitler later on. From him, Chanel incorporated aesthetic items of Imperial Russia and cavalry officers, gilt buttons embossed with different emblems, which mimicked heraldic crests, military sashes, costume jewelry that looked like the Romanov jewels, and most notably, in 1921, here are some of her early crest buttons, which she entirely made up. They're nobody's crest. Most famously, in 1921, he gave her pearls, the last heirloom pearls of the Romanovs, and she immediately went out and had them made in paste copies and wore dozens of them with the real Romanov pearls sort of hidden amid them. It drove him crazy. So I like that she did. That's a classic course to her. And in, also in 21, she invented her famous double C logo while she was dating the Romanov Duke. That logo represented the first time a designer turned her signature into an adornment and a badge of identity. We were talking earlier about badges of identity. The logo, the CCs, eclipsed all the other motifs. So, for example, that tended to disappear in favor of the CC logo, which then appeared on jacket buttons and belts, shoes, purses, and acquired enough cachet to turn into an abstract, impersonal status symbol, even while conjuring the person behind the initials. It took on a kind of life of its own. During World War II, the only thing she continued to sell was her perfume. She shuttered her house, but she continued to sell her perfume. German soldiers would line up around the block to buy the perfume to send back home to girlfriends and wives, but when the perfume ran out, as it eventually did, German soldiers would come in and grab the empty boxes off the store shelves on the Rue Cambon in order to send something back home to their wives with that CC emblem on it. So the emblem became inextricable from the identity of the Chanel brand and appeared somewhere on nearly all the accessories and perfume packages. like a royal coat of arms or a military medal. These interlocked seeds labeled an elite status, which conferred its special magic on any item that displayed it. Bourdieu, in fact, cites Chanel when he writes of the magical and religious properties of what he calls transubstantiation, provided by the designer's signature label. In a very deft move, Chanel turned initials, which of course is the most individual emblem you can have, right? It signifies personal ownership and one's own identity. It's the opposite of a royal crest, which signifies, you know, membership and continuing descendants. She turned that into a stamp of privileged group identity. That logo crystallizes a kind of paradoxical brilliance at the heart of the whole Chanel empire. It grants prestige through uniformity, through mass identification with one idealized individual. The logo creates an inner circle of initiates who know how to read those letters and know what they mean. And that circle of initiates expanded steadily. Now, nearly everyone could own something with a logo. She made sure the perfume was priced at a point, some versions that were affordable to most, and everybody wanted to. Other signs of especially male aristocracy found their way into her work. She incorporated British tweeds when she was dating the Duke of Westminster, turning English aristocratic menswear, hunting jackets, riding clothes, men's style overcoats, into something that was coded very female and also oddly very French. While the press speculated on Chanel's marrying and becoming the actual Duchess of Westminster, thousands of women were buying the clothes she was photographed wearing or copies of them on the yacht or at horse races with, and here she is wearing some of his hunting style gear with her friend Vera Bates. This particular combination of elitism and populism was the key to her success. She created a uniform of easily copyable clothes that also connotes exclusivity and status, while being easily reproducible in machine-made fabrics. Also, I'd like to point out that whenever you see photos of Chanel with other women, you'll notice a kind of mimetic contagion. The women always wind up looking like her. Not only are they always dressed by her, but they tend to assume her body posture. And I think this is, it's always she who's taking the lead, and it's just a sort of mini version of what I'm talking about, this mimetic contagion, this desire to emulate, which is very apparently profound in her presence. Women clamored for her outfits and implicitly for piece of this accessible fantasy. And this is why she turned out to be rather good as a costume designer. And I want to talk briefly about her costume work now, because it helps explain how that mythic character worked. For 30 years, she costumed film, theater, and dance. She worked in France and in Hollywood as well. And the strange thing is, she really didn't design costumes. Essentially, she put all the characters in versions of Chanel fashion, with very little concession to whatever the fiction was that she was costuming. Perfect example. This is Chanel on the left, and on the right, you see Gloria Swanson in costume by Chanel for the film Tonight or Never, 1932. Chanel did all the women's clothes, and as you can see, she essentially dressed the lead character as herself. To wear a Chanel costume was to wear Chanel. Most relevant here are the things Chanel produced for the Neo-Hellenist plays of Jean Cocteau, and I'll tell you why. She called Cocteau's series of Greek plays a bazaar of antiquity. And here you have her work for, on the left, Cocteau's version of Sophocles' Antigone. That's actress Zenica Athanasiou in 1922 as Antigone. And on the right, a Chanel winter coat from the same year in a French fashion magazine. The only difference is the fur collar. Both are jacquard-woven long coats in brown, black, and beige. And I'm going to use this as my example, although she also did Orpheus, Oedipus. She helped on the ballet russe's Zephyr and Flora, and also Les Biches. She did the costumes, some of the costumes as well for that. But in the case of Antigone, when asked why Chanel was doing the costumes, which she had never done before, Cocteau was asked in an interview, he said, "I cannot imagine the daughters of Oedipus would be badly dressed." But that's important. By the way, set designer for that production was Picasso, and Artaud was playing Tiresias. It was a very sort of star-studded cast. But the cast looked like it had stepped out of her couture collection for winter 1922. In fact, the former title of my book was Antigone in Vogue, but they made me change it because they said no one would know who Antigone was. Her winter collection, as you see, and here's a better example. Winter collection, right? Antigone on the left. On stage, she wore these heavy wool garments, but it's also important to think about who Antigone was. She was the protagonist. She was the fierce sister of the two sisters, and she had the more dramatic ensemble. She also had a woolen dress tied with a rope belt. Her sister, Ismene, do I have Ismene? I'm sorry, I don't have Ismene. Ismene wore a short dress with no cloak, and the reason is that Ismene is not noble. If you recall your Sophocles, at the beginning, Antigone says to her sister, "Show your nobility, show your race," is the translation Cocteau gave. "Montre-ta-race," show your race, why aren't you helping me bury our brother Polynices? And Ismene backs out. So Antigone is the noble one. Antigone is connected to her ancestry. Antigone gets the more Chanel-esque outfit. Okay? So the nobility of this mythological princess was connoted in the play via Chanel style, which had acquired by this time, it's only 1922, a kind of nobility, a kind of superior race, in quotations. And the audience understood. The play was a hit largely because of the costumes. Critics talked about it to the exclusion of Sophocles, Cocteau, Picasso, everyone else. It was Chanel that the reviews were about. French Vogue said the costumes resembled ancient clothes discovered after centuries. Chanel has become Greek while remaining Chanel. The Christian Science Monitor lauded the costumes for remedying what they saw as a dangerous effeminate trend in costuming. So for them, her costumes were virile. In fact, the word virile is even used. Strong and somewhat masculine, and therefore worthy, again, of the ancient Greeks. So you hear there the undertone of how critical reception to Chanel, these costumes, foreshadow Chanel and, by the way, Antigone's later popularity among French fascists and proto-fascists. In that, critics found her style lofty, monumental, virile, and worthy of France's grand Hellenic past. So she evoked ancient Greece and high culture gravitas, Sophocles, while remaining true to her own fictive universe and that Coco character, which was potent and recognizable, as much so even as Antigone. Coco had risen to the stature of myth. And Cocteau's Antigone proved that she could recreate Theban nobility via the feu combat. Roland Barthes would have agreed with that. In 1967, he declared in an essay that Chanel ought to be considered a 17th century canonical French literary figure, and that she should be classed alongside Racine and Pascal. And she did much the same thing with the other productions she costumed, dropping her own mythological character, that's what I'm calling the Coco character, in among the Clytemnestras, Jocastas, and Eurydices of French modernism, adding glamour. But they, in turn, enhanced her mythic operation. Sorry about that. It's not that bad. Well, maybe it's worse for you. It might get really hot, so don't suffer. I can talk louder. Better? Okay. So off stage, when she was doing her regular fashion work, Chanel's mythic infusion worked a lot the way it did on stage. I think the stage costumes give a very good condensed version of what I'm trying to discuss, because she conveyed her own kind of stock character of indeterminate nobility and elitism, which increasingly had a military feel to it. Jean Cocteau, who was her great friend, wrote that fashion is a nearly military discipline and inflicts a uniform. And he was thinking specifically of Coco. It was more than a metaphor for her. From her earliest days, she was putting wealthy duchesses in little sailor suits that she got inspired by from military styles of World War I. And this is one of the examples. This is a reconstruction, actually, of her 1917 sailor suit. Lagerfeld put this back together, but it's pretty accurate, and it was copied directly from French naval, not officers, what are the youngest ones called? Beyond these clean lines and athletic ease, the uniforms were really attractive to Chanel because they had an aura of masculine desirability, which she gravitated to increasingly. Throughout the 30s, she became even more military and more streamlined and used more uniform-like suits, although they always they ramped upward towards more officer-like styles. At the same time, privately in her politics, she grew more and more right-wing and defensively nationalist. On the left is a 19th century hussard military uniform, and on the right are suits from the early to mid-50s with the same Brandenburg or frog style closures and her the beginnings of the more boucle looking knit. Back right, by the way, that's Lagerfeld. Ignore the mini skirt. That's not hers. So I want to talk a bit for a moment about her Frenchness, which is an essential part of her appeal and her success, what the French call francité, right, Frenchiness. She remained painfully conscious all her life of having started as an outcast, as a needy convent girl, and she claimed that this caused her a sense of great national anomie. She told one biographer, "In France, an unknown foreign woman is never suspect, but for French women, it is not the same. One must be known to be recognized, and that is not my case." So in other words, she felt it would have been easier for her to be foreign, because as a French woman of an obscure background with no family, in the sense of aristocratic family, she felt she was considered an interloper. She felt, that is, a foreigner in her own country. And I think we can find at least some explanation for her well-documented anti-Semitism in this. Chanel and many of her cohort were inclined to distance themselves from any people they considered rootless or lacking a nation, an orphaned people. "Of all groups," she told a friend, "I am most afraid of the Jews." And I would dare say it's because she felt like a Jew, in some sense, a kind of rootless outsider in her own country. And so she spent a lot of time trying to remedy that. Her solution to the problem of this French anonymity was simple. "For most women in the world, France is me," she says. That's not even wrong, if you think about it. She wanted to become, and indeed managed to become, a kind of allegory of France. In another interview, she said, "Nations have a style. One has a style when everyone on the street is dressed like one. I have achieved this." So, you know, talk about style nation. She sort of founded her own little country and then decided that she was the avatar for this, the look of the country. But it worked. In anyone else, you would say this was madness, but in the case of Chanel, it actually succeeded. She also wrote, "I wanted to escape and become the center of a universe of my own creation." And so in this quest for connectedness, or its appearance at least, she spent a lifetime compensating by substituting her French nationality, that francité, for the illustrious family lineage she felt she should have had and envied so in the aristocrats she befriended. She created, that is, a substitutive genealogy of nationhood through personality. She restyled herself as a daughter of France. She even claimed to be a direct descendant of Louis IX, Saint Louis, patron saint of Paris. And by extension, she created an empire around herself. She had a bust in her room, in her living room, of a kind of a porcelain bust of an abbey, and she said this was the Abbe Chanel, her great illustrious ancestor. But in fact, it was the uncle of one of her boyfriends. But it presided over her home, and she told everyone it was, you know, a guarantor of her aristocracy. But France accepted this. France was happy to make her its national icon. During the economically rocky 1930s, couture remained one of the last few great French industries and exports, the way the world defined France. And within that, the Frenchest of the French couturiers was always Chanel, a status she loved and played up. The increasingly military look of her work, its reliance on badges, that insignia, and so forth, partook of this desire to create a kind of private army of her own highly French nation, a nation of women. This infused the mythic character of her work. From 1932, I just wanted to show some of the military styling. From 1932 to 35, she was involved with the artist and somewhat fanatical French patriot, Paul Hirige, often considered the father of Art Deco. And she even subsidized his weekly political magazine, which was called The Witness or Le Témoin. It was an extreme anti-modernist, racist, xenophobic, anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-everything publication. Its stated goal was to make France French again, and advocated for a kind of luxury patriotism, which meant in this case that France would recapture its glory of pre-revolutionary times via luxury good trade. So Irib, in the pages of this magazine, wrote, "You must defend as if they were our flag, French silk, fabric, fashion, jewelry, and perfume." So if fashion and jewelry were the flag of Irib's France, Coco Chanel was its national monarch, for his queen. And every week, for 3 years, Cartoon Chanel served as a weekly icon for this journal, which turned her into his version of Marianne, plastered over all the newspaper kiosks. He never identified this woman as Chanel, and she only wore a Phrygian cap and flowing robes. But she was known by everyone who read this magazine immediately, not least because she was a famous designer, but because she was virtually already Marianne for a certain group, especially the proto-fascist, arch-nationalist French before World War II. This is Marianne Coco on the cross. I think I have a few of this. Here she is lamenting the Zelensky affair, which I won't go into now, but it was a corruption scandal. Here she is wearing more of her military regalia of that period. She embraced this view of herself, the view that Irib gave her, her view of herself as a kind of military royal leader, increasingly during the 1930s, especially as the strikes and unrest of that period frightened and angered her, particularly also the rise of the Popular Front, the election of Léon Blum, France's first Jewish prime minister. These things made her nuts. And in response, in 1934, she wrote, "I must create an even more aristocratic fashion." So there was a strange sort of ancien regime nostalgia and desire that she evinced to compensate for this anxiety. Her politics played themselves out in her clothing, which became a movement, a way of life, a constellation of visual associations and references that was recognizable to millions. Although it began as a purely commercial business about female adornment, the Chanel empire rooted itself increasingly in something deeper, in a kind of mythic underpinning, a Weltanschauung, and that's why I call it Chanelism. It was a social movement of women's material culture which blended tokens of elite belonging, simulacra of royal status, military uniformity, luxury, and exaggerated Frenchness, all channeled through this one charismatic individual in her compelling personal mythos. "She is the image of what she has created," wrote one journalist in 1937. In fact, the English expression total look, the total look, was actually invented for her in France because she was the first to create a kind of all-encompassing system like that. The film star Romy Schneider said, "Chanel's style is a coherent, logical, ordered whole in the sense of the Doric order or Corinthian order. There is Chanel order." And I think it's very telling that Romy Schneider spoke of classical architecture when she was describing this, because she's looking to the ancient world to explain Chanel's classical totality. And that brings me to my last section, which is about Chanelism's odd and startling resemblance to fascism. And I'm not talking here about her famous love affairs with Nazis, which, you know, did happen more than once. And I'm not talking about her espionage work, not only during World War II, but apparently also during World War I. And I'm not talking about how she personally took part in rooting and pillaging the homes of Jewish Parisians. Not biography. I'm talking about Chanel's relationship to fascism via her work. One of the key aspects of fascism is its relationship to masses of people, right, to crowds. It worked a kind of special transformative magic on the crowds. It gave them shape, it gave them purpose, and it conferred, the appeal of fascism had to do with conferring upon thousands of participants, even those who were from very humble backgrounds, an ennobling transcendence, a sense of belonging. The images that we have of fascism in history, the ones that stay in our minds, are all of enormous crowds, the Nuremberg rallies, for example, Hitler's speeches. I'll just turn back to that for a moment. From scenes like this, a great paradox emerges. It's a pleasure in mass spectacle that insists at the same time on the essential superiority of every single one of these thousands of people. So it's about a natural aristocratic blood sense, right? But at the same time, this is elitism's opposite. This is the comfort of being lost in a crowd, dissolved in an ocean wave. And this is why it was so seductive. Fascism promised acquirable greatness without the burden or the loneliness of standing out. It was a way to transcend the masses while being held securely in the masses. Elitism and egalitarianism. And it was beautifully packaged, right? It was glossy and had the appeal of a high-end ad campaign. This is why Benjamin famously said that Nazi propaganda aestheticized politics. And at the root of it was the story of fascist man, the uber-masculine, athletic, ancient Greek, the Aryan man who was the origin of the superior European, right? And returning to these origins would require purging the population of any polluting lower races and elevating the new renaissance of this figure. A new chosen people would be defined against a vilified other. And a nostalgia for this manufactured past was made very poignant and created through artwork. This is Arno Brecker's statue of the party. Like all myths, this one inspired imitation by provoking identification in the crowd and inciting them to emulate the myth's heroic figures. And not only did they have beautiful bodies, but they had beautiful uniforms, as you know. And the techniques that they used to appeal to crowds borrowed heavily from all 20th century forms of mass recreation, organized sports, cinema, and especially fashion, using the lure of a privileged group of insiders, an insistence on youth, on fitness, on physical beauty, on a distinctly recognizable style, and powerful, charismatic personalities. Fascism, as Susan Sontag pointed out, was sexy. And with fascist man, there was the sense of exercise being a possible route to this superior being. So it was about the covered body and the uncovered body, all defined sharply against the Jews and this sort of inchoate, physically inferior anti-type, right? And this had appeal in France as well as in the countries where fascism took stronger hold, like Italy and Germany. So those uniforms, sleek, form-fitting, in both Italy and Germany, were great for showing off the physique underneath. The boots, the leather trench coats, and the elaborate system of badges. It is hot, man. Hang on. aren't you hot? Are you all right? I don't want to torture you. You think it's still loud out there? So you get the idea of what I'm saying. Thank you. The idea is basically that the fascist appeal was about a sleek, masculine, athletic, form-fitting uniform that was bedecked with medallions of rank, and particularly the swastika, which made for a total look that conveyed not only military authority, but masculine beauty, sculpting the collective body. Right. And this was a culture where the swastika acquired this mystical power, but its opposite acquired another kind of power, the Star of David, that started being required of Jews in European countries. And at the very same time, you have the CC logo becoming the most powerful commercial logo brand. So I'm calling this era a culture and an era of logos. The fascist uniform was not the only thing that had the swastika, of course. A wide range of Nazi merchandise saturated the marketplace, and you could get swastika watches and pins and jackets and jewelry. You could even get lingerie bedecked with swastikas. They were available for sale. It was a fashion accessory because Nazism was a civic religion, as George Moss, the great historian of fashion, has pointed out. So this was mass national unification by means of icons, color, object, clothing, crowd formation that was so essential. They even had a name for it. It was called Gleichschaltung, meaning same switch. I don't know, would that be fair?
That's right. Yeah.
Gleichschaltung. Uniformization. So in a nutshell, my argument is, in her own way, I'm not saying she was conscious of this, but parallel to this whole system, which was taking over vast swaths of Europe, the Chanel empire was forming via a charismatic individual promoting an athletic, androgynous, medallion-bedecked, logo-bedecked, masculine uniformity with a single individual standing for an emulatable, demotic elitism. Does this not perhaps suggest the power of what she was doing, both what infused it, but why it was so very successful? Because, as I think some of you might agree with me, she's not the best designer in the world. There, I can name 10 designers off the top of my head who I think are far more talented from her era and before and after. She's the one we remember. She's the one that every single person I meet has heard of, even if they have no idea of what else goes on in fashion. She was tapping into something that's very deep, which Sontag refers to as the nefarious longing in us all. Right? I want to show you something. These are Nazi embossed buttons of the time. These are some Jewish Parisian ladies who are wearing the required Star of David. This is a lady in a Mussolini bathing suit because his charismatic image was an important conveyor of Italian fascism, and his virile image was considered an adornment. But here, I don't know if you can see, this is Hitler's bodyguard, his private Leibstandarte, and these cuffs, all of their uniforms, which Hitler required, are embroidered with his signature in silver. It's the only time I know of, maybe some of you know of another instance, where a military uniform carried the signature of a military leader as an adornment. And obviously, this channels some of the same talismanic power that fashion uses with La Grise, the designer label. This was an elite unit. They wore a special black uniform, and they all wore Führer's signature around their wrists. Signature branding in the military. As some of us were talking about the other day, last night I guess it was at dinner, fascism for women was kind of a flop. There weren't the great, gorgeous uniforms for the women. There were uniforms for sports leagues and auxiliary leagues and so forth, but they were never satisfied, either in Germany or in Italy. They kept redoing them, that nobody liked them, because the fascist woman was encouraged to be a kind of fertility goddess, a kind of retro, child-rearing, plow-driving housefrau, which did not jive with the desires of modern women of the time. who all wanted to wear French fashion. So it was a continual source of sort of aggravation to Hitler, particularly, who kept requiring that the women's uniforms for different things be redesigned. They couldn't get it right. Chanel got it right. Nobody asked her. But it's my contention that she inducted women into some of the pleasures that fascism actually offered men by creating a kind of female prototype which embodied a lot of the same characteristics: athleticism, power, emulating a hero, uniformity with elitism, tokens of status, all at the very same time. Athletic, military. Oh, there's the Hitler signature. And there's a typical poster. As you can see, that fascist man and the missus, right? A vaguely Grecian, in this case, to hark back to Hellenic roots, but not fashion. And this is the cartoon I was telling you about. This was the lamenting about the modern woman in France, and the propaganda always suggested that the modern woman was going to decimate the country because there'd be no child rearing. The modern woman who wore fashion, read fashion magazines, was en route to that, to emaciated debauchery, and this was the desirable woman. Well, Chanel was more on the right-hand side, right? She was a skinny, fashionable, childless, never married woman. But nobody ever seemed to complain about her. So this is a paradox that I've been trying to work through, and I think it's because for a certain very large segment, far larger all the time the more research is done, segment of the French population, this was necessary. This inducted women into a certain kind of politics that was making possible other things that were going on in France and in the rest of Europe. And my contention is that it's actually more powerful than fascism, because while fascism was defeated, Chanelism continues to live a healthy life and had a renaissance in America after the war, where the same exact look was touted as inherently American. Clean cut, athletic, that's the American gal. And of course there's a through line you can trace from fascist man, from the Aryan sort of Hellenic ancestor, through fascist man, through the all-American guy and the English, the clean cut Englishman, all the way to the Great Gatsby and beyond, to Ralph Lauren, Jewish guy who revamped his whole life and created an empire of aristocratic American WASP privilege. He's the descendant of this. So I think Chanel was instrumental in creating this. And this does not mean that I think if you wear Chanel that you are a fascist. What it means is that she powerfully tapped into some psychological and political undertones in Europe, which I call the fashion unconscious, which I think we're still living with today. So I will leave you with that. I know it went long. I apologize, and it's hot. So thank you.